Kia ora and welcome to our final episode of this series. We'd like to thank Alison Balance and the team at RNZ who brought us the Kakapo Files and Voice of the Kakapo series which inspired the Kakapod. Go and listen to them now if you haven't already. For our final show, Dr. Andrew Digby sat down with us to reflect on the 2022 breeding season and discuss the future of Kakapo recovery. We also have some awards to hand out. But I started by asking Andrew how he's feeling about the breeding season and why such a high percentage of chicks have survived.
Good. Yeah, good actually. Yeah, it actually feels like quite a long time ago. We're very much in planning ahead at the moment. You know, we've just lost one of those 55 that fledged, which is pretty unusual. But it feels very comfortable and good that we have so many of the chicks still surviving. We had a good remu year. That would have given the chicks a really good start. So they fledged in good condition. We got pretty lucky and with a bit of management around the aspergillosis that didn't hit like it did last time. So that definitely had an impact. You know, we're kind of roughly following the same procedure we have that in previous years. We do have much better monitoring now that might have played a small part in it. It certainly played a part in detecting ill health in some of the birds. But yeah, there's nothing I can immediately say, but you know, I think it's something that we might look into.
So while the survival rate has been excellent, it doesn't mean the kakapo are out of the woods yet. There's been an unfortunate flare-up of exudative cloacitis, otherwise known as crusty bum.
It's the very descriptive term, and it's exactly what it says on the tin. Yeah, it's something which has been around since 2002, and it kind of comes and goes. And we had a big peak of it in 2016, and then we did quite a bit of work. A lot of checking, and in 2017, 2018, it really died away, and then it kicked up again in 2020, and we've actually had a lot of cases in the last few years. It really seems to be escalating. In fact, I think we've had 46 birds in total affected by it in the last 20 years, and about half of those have come in the last 3 years. We still don't know what causes it, so that's a real focus for us.
So with all that cleaned up, who will clean up in the awards? Welcome down here to the red carpet for the 2022 Kakapo Breeding Season Awards. I'm your host Jez Brown, and I can tell you, many of the birds have gone all out on their plumage this year, some really dazzling olive and green numbers making their way up the ramp as we speak. Ah, here's Sirocco. Let's see if we can get a word. How are you feeling this evening, Sirocco? Classic. We'll pass that on to Stephen Fry, Sirocco. Always a jacket. But it sounds like they're getting ready for us up inside the Stewart Island Palladium. Ladies and gentlemen, in your first award for this evening, he danced the dance of a thousand dancers. Your leading man for the 2022 breeding season was...
Takingi did well on anchor. I think he fathered 10 chicks. So yeah, he was a bit of a standout on anchor. I think Basil was the next. He had 4 chicks. So Takingi was a long way ahead in terms of the males on Anchor Island. Gulliver did really well on Whenua Ho, produced 4 chicks. And he's one of our really important field and founders. He's got kind of unusual genetics. We think there's these genes called MHC genes, the disease resistance genes. And he has a set of MHC alleles, which is the variants of those genes, which are completely different to any other kakapo. So we know that he's genetically unique. There's obviously other kakapo, which will be too, but he's one of the more special ones. So it's really cool to get 4 chicks out of him. And Boss as well also got 4 chicks too. So yeah, of those males, they're probably the standouts.
Now prepared to be dazzled by a number of leading lights amongst the ladies.
We didn't have any huge clutches from the females this year, but some really quite solid performance in terms of like Apolima, Araluura, Marion, Gertrude all produced 3 chicks each on Anchor. Pearl produced 3 chicks on Whenua Ho. So yeah, we had lots of solid performers, I think. Yeah, which was really good.
Our third award for the evening for standout performance by a female in a breeding season.
We had Alice. I think Alice produced a chick that was a son, I think, on a male on Whenua Ho. That was 41 years after she was found nesting on Rakiura when she was discovered back in 1981. So, yeah, that's pretty cool. We know she'll have been at least 5 years old when she was discovered if she was nesting, but we have no idea beyond that. We just have no way of aging kakapo, unfortunately. We've tried 4 different methods. They have all failed. They all work on other species. They do not work on kakapo. So, yeah, it's a bit of a mystery of how old some of those original birds are. She could have been 5, she could have been 25, she could have been 35 when she was discovered. We just don't know. So it gives us a minimum age of probably 46 years or 47 now. But yeah, she could be quite a few decades older than that.
And now the standout performance in a breeding season by a male. Put your hands together for Big Merv, who produced his first ever chicks.
Yeah, he did. He did. So he had an artificial insemination offspring, which is pretty cool, along with Luke and Sinbad. So the artificial insemination was a real highlight from this year that they actually, yeah, got it working. And he had chicks with Wehepo. Also with Ruth, I think Ruth and Wehepo were his two. I have no idea how old Merv is. You know, he might be 50, he might be 60, he might be older than that, he could be 80 years old. We just really don't know. We kind of have, a little bit of an indication from Richard Henry. Richard Henry was found as an adult in 1975 in Fiordland. He died in 2010. So, you know, that's 35 years later. We suspect, we don't know for sure, but breeding probably would not have happened in Fiordland much beyond the middle of the 20th century. So he might have been hatched as a chick in the 40s. Maybe even the 30s. Yeah, we don't really know for sure, but he could have easily been 80 years old when he died. So they might live 90, 100 years, but that's very much a guess.
So Merv, against all the odds, sired 3 chicks with Wehepo and Ruth, Turuopo, Kevin and Andy. But how do they decide who would be a likely mum for artificial insemination?
So we have a genetic process for doing that. We had a project called the Kakapo 125 Project, which is sequencing the genomes of all of the kakapo. And what we've been able to produce from that, with a lot of help from quite a few geneticists, is a matrix, basically, which is a relatedness score between every male and every female. So it gives you how good a match they are. We use that score as a ranking system. We also take into account things like those rare genes that I talked about, and also things like how many offspring they have in terms of founders as well. So it's a little bit of a matchmaking process, but primarily on that genetic matrix. So when we're actually looking for a match for Merv, in fact, we do it the other way around. We choose the female first, and we try and skew it towards those males which have never had offspring before. It's actually quite a process. So what will happen is that we identify a female who has recently mated. You know that she is laying eggs or about to lay eggs. So what you're trying to do, you'll have missed that first egg. You're then trying to get the subsequent eggs that she lays. We pick up the right time window, normally about 2 or 3 days after she has mated, sometimes one day, and then we will go and catch suitable males for her. So a team will go out, try to catch those males and try to get sperm out of those males. And so that kind of sounds easy, but it's actually can be quite a process. You're obviously walking quite long distances to find those males. You've got to catch them. Sometimes they'll be up a tree, and then you've got to try and get the sperm from them, which is not a straightforward task. And then once you've got those samples, sometimes we'll keep them separate, sometimes we'll pull them, and then we have to try and get the female. And that's kind of the bit where you have to be quick. Every sort of minute that you take means the chance of success is reduced. So we hurry to try and get those females, and that's where the sperm drone has come in the past. And we didn't use that this year because we didn't have a sufficient enough team. You really need 2 teams to do that, one to send, one to receive. But you go to find the female, capture the female, hope that she's not up a tree, because then all your work would have been in vain. Catch her and then inseminate her, and that's actually really quite a quick procedure.
So seminal air was grounded this year, but why inseminate birds who have already mated?
There definitely is a reason. That's one of the things that we've found. We think that artificial insemination will encourage sperm competition in kakapo, and we've recently done some analysis which has shown that sperm competition, we think, is related to fertility in kakapo. The more times a female kakapo mates, the higher the fertility of her clutch will be, particularly if she mates with different males. So if one female mates with one male, the fertility of her clutch is roughly around about 50% or so. If she mates twice with the same male, it goes up to around about 3/4. And if she mates with different males, it goes up to about a 90% chance of that clutch being fertile. So it makes a big difference if she mates with different males. And that's where we think the sperm competition comes in. And so if that's not happening naturally, because about half of females mate only with one male, then we can encourage that sperm competition, we think, by artificially mating them with another male, or even more. Artificial insemination is pretty intensive, but it achieves two things. It encourages that sperm competition, hopefully improves the fertility. Also, it gives those males who have never produced offspring a chance of doing so. So that's one way that we can encourage, I think, higher fertility and better representation. Also, we are looking at sort of stocking rates, effectively, the density of kakapo on islands, because it seems to be that the more females there are on an island, the higher fertility, because they'll have multiple matings. And so that's something that we're starting to look at, is actually we might start to increase the density of females on some of the islands where we can. There's always some males that we don't want involved in breeding, whether they're males who are overrepresented or whether they're males who are perhaps the duds, they tend to be infertile, or more often the juvenile males who will be infertile. They'll try to mate, but they'll produce infertile clutches. And also they tend to interfere with the nests as well. So we want them kind of out of the way in the breeding season.
So some of the boys, possibly lots of them, will be subbed off to Bachelor Islands to muse amongst themselves about where all the girls have gone, while a lucky few will be left back on planet Amazonia to have snoo snoo. But that begs another question. With all the success, where to put all these kakapo?
So those islands are full. I think we've got roughly about mid-80s, 86 or something, kakapo on Whenuaho. We've got 100 on anchor. So yep, they're definitely, anchor's definitely over full. And so we are going to be moving kakapo to new sites, and we're looking at moving kakapo to Mangatautri, which is a fence sanctuary in the North Island, later this year. And next year we are potentially looking at some other islands in Fiordland, such as Cole Island. It's not completely confirmed yet, but we're thinking about other sites. So we definitely need to shift round about 40 kakapo before the next breeding season, which will probably happen in 2026, we think. And after that, we'll probably need to shift another 50 or so, we think. So we are in desperate need of new sites for kakapo. And it's a problem because there are no really suitable sites. There's some issues with all of them. So yeah, we've identified the ones that are most likely. Mangatautri is looking really good. Some of those other sites I talked about, the Fiordland Islands, we have issues with some stoat incursions. So there's a chance that we will be mixing kakapo and stoats in the next few years because we don't have any other alternative.
So you heard it here first. Kakapo are likely to be returning to the North Island of New Zealand, and the next breeding season is likely to be 2026. But if stoats are a problem, what about the plans to make Rakiura pest-free?
Yeah, those plans are still going ahead, and that is our number one site. That's the best site that we think is available for kakapo. And we know that they bred really well there. We know there's lots of rimu there. They do very well. They've got a history there. So yeah, that's the place. We would put them there tomorrow if it was pest-free, but unfortunately it's got rats and cats and possums. And so it's a plan to get rid of those. And yeah, that's going to take some time to do that. Some people are suggesting short time frames in the next 5 years or so. I think it's more likely to be at least a decade or so before that's possible. Feral cats are actually a huge problem on Rakiura. There's a lot of feral cats there, and you see them all over the place. So that's probably the biggest issue. And it's those cats which made kakapo become extinct almost in the first place on Rakiura. So it was only because they were translocated off that they survived. If not, they would have been extinct caused by cats. So, yep, the cats are a huge issue. There's no way that they can coexist.
So Rakiura will hopefully become pest-free, but how might that benefit other species?
That's a good question. Kakapo are kind of one of these flagship species, get a lot of attention. Other species get a lot less attention, and you know, can be a source of contention sometimes. You know, kakapo get more funding and more attention. We need people to care about snails more or something like that. But I think that works both ways. When we're looking at kakapo, putting kakapo on new sites, those sites will end up receiving probably a better level of protection than they would otherwise have done. And so that's a benefit for the whole ecosystem as a result of having kakapo there. For example, Whenuaho was initially cleared of pest species of the rats and the possums because of kakapo. And so that now is an incredible thriving habitat for a lot of different species. So that's one angle. Another angle is we have quite a lot of technology in Kakapo recovery, certainly in the New Zealand sense, and I think in an international sense, we push the technology of how to monitor birds. So for example, we have real-time activity monitoring for nearly all of our population at the moment. We can detect health problems from just sitting on a computer and the internet anywhere in the world. That sort of technology then can flow through to other species. Some of the feeder technology that we use, for example, for feeding birds, that's been used elsewhere too. So that's definitely, I think, some of the ways that the Kakapo program can benefit other species like that.
So what else does the future look like for Kakapo recovery?
I think the thing I'm looking forward to most is doing less. And that's something that we really pushed in this last breeding season. We push it every year, but we pushed it an extra level this year because Kakapo management is incredibly intensive. When I first joined the team, I was blown away by how intensive it was. And it's too intensive. It's too intensive to be sustainable in the long term. Also, it seemed that males, which were hand-reared, had lower fertility than males, which were wild-reared in a nest. That's something that we will revisit as we have more data, but we will be taking a more precautionary approach and reduce the hand-rearing, especially for males, as much as we can. Now, hand-rearing is important for Kakapo. If we didn't have hand-rearing, we would have a lot less Kakapo than we do now. It's essential for a lot of birds. There would be a lot of birds that would die without it. But there's some cases where maybe we can take a bit more of a gamble and push it a little bit more. And that's actually what we did in this last breeding season. And we don't know why those males have lower fertility. We suspect it might be a behavioral thing. It might just be there's some crucial part of their development. They're not around other Kakapo, or they're missing out some natural behavior, which means maybe they just can't mate effectively. And we see that sort of imprinting on Sinbad, who tries to mate with people. And we kind of see that a little bit with Sirocco, for example. It's because he's too imprinted on humans. He was the only Kakapo which was reared on his own. He was the first Kakapo who was hand-reared. He was reared on his own for a long time. And we've since found that if a male was reared on its own, then it will become quite imprinted. Females don't seem to have the same effect, funnily enough. But it definitely seems to impact males. And so that's why when we do hand-rear Kakapo, we tend to rear them in groups. Now we keep the time that they're hand-reared alone to the absolute minimum. I cannot spend the same amount of effort per Kakapo that we have done in the past. You know, pretty much our funding either flatlines or declines over time, but the number of birds is increasing dramatically. We've had like 100% increase since 2016, for example. So we need to really up our game in terms of our management, and that's where the remote monitoring really comes in. This year we took quite a step back, particularly on Anchor Island. We left most chicks to hatch in their nests, which is something that we haven't done in the past. Previously, we artificially incubated them and hatched them in an incubator. This year, we had 2 eggs per nest and let them hatch naturally, which was a really, really special thing to be able to sort of be part of, really. You went to a nest, you didn't know if you were going to find an egg or if you were going to find a chick that had just hatched. So that was pretty cool. And particularly on Te Kākahu this year, we did an experiment on Te Kākahu whereby instead of checking chicks or nests every 2 or 3 nights or every 1 night sometimes, we only checked them 3 times in about 4 months. So we checked for fertility initially, we checked on the point of hatch, and then we checked on fledge. We really took a backseat approach, and we weren't even on the island at all. We were just monitoring those nests remotely. And that worked well. We ended up with 3 chicks and 3 nests there. So that's kind of the future for Kakapo, I think, that we will do more and more of that sort of thing. We'll be much more hands-off and just let them do their own thing. And yeah, one day, I can't wait for the day. I don't know if I'll still be alive. I hope I will be, when we just have Kakapo without transmitters on. We just let them go without transmitters and just let them do their thing.
We're coming to the end of this series. We certainly have our favourite Kakapo. I'm sure you have yours. Love you, Merv. But does Dr. Andrew Digby have any favourites of his own?
Gulliver's always a favourite. Yeah, Gulliver. Yeah, Gulliver's a great Kakapo. It's cool to see him doing well, even though he wasn't directly involved in that island. Yeah, I'm not a big one for favourites, to be honest. I'm a bit of the scientist, so I tend to try and keep a bit of detachment from those things. Waikawa is a bit of a favourite on Anchor. She tends to have some pretty cool nests. She had an amazing nest this year, which was in a hollow tree over a stream. Trying to find that nest was great fun because we're searching this area for ages and ages and just couldn't work out where the nest was. And it was only then we realised it was actually inside a tree about 3 metres off the ground hanging over a stream. That's not your typical place where you'd find it. Find a Kakapo nest, so that was a good one. A bit of affection for Gem A2, who became Athena. I helped that chick hatch. It was stuck in the hatching process and would have died, but I kind of luckily went there at the right time, found out it was stuck and helped it out of its shell. So yeah, those sort of things always stick with you.
So we've come to the end of the 2022 kakapo breeding season. Thank you for taking this journey with us. My great personal thanks to Kate Harrison, who's put in so much work behind the scenes, not just editing, but researching, writing, and keeping the ball rolling. Our friends at Cricket Farm have provided the soundtrack throughout, so why not give them a Google? You can find their music across the internet. Finally, we'd like to thank Kakapo Recovery for all their tireless work keeping the kakapo around on planet Earth. The world is a better place for having this bird and all the work they do to keep it here with us. We might be taking a break, but they sure won't, so stay in touch with their social media for all the updates and opportunities for you to help out and be involved in the preservation of this wonderful olive and green feathered oddball. This episode was written and recorded by Jez Brown and edited by Kate Harrison. But we'll leave the final word of this season to Dr. Andrew Digby. Thank you again, bird lovers. Haerera.
We're the lucky ones. We get to see a kakapo breeding season and we get to be part of that. I'm always blown away by how many people are interested in kakapo, especially people who don't live in New Zealand, who live around the world and may never ever get to even see a kakapo, but they still lend their support. Yeah, just huge thanks to them. And especially to all the volunteers who come out and help us as well. People give up at least 2 weeks of their time in the breeding season to come onto the islands and work in some pretty tough conditions sometimes. Yeah, that's really appreciated.